eye on worldly pleasure and the other on religion, and who thinks he can have the advantage of both conditions, will not be thorough either in his pleasure-seeking or his religion, but will make a sorry business of both. It is better to be a whole-souled worldling than a half-hearted religionist, better to give the entire mind to a lower thing than half of it to a higher. It is preferable to be thorough, even if it be in a bad or selfish direction, rather than inefficient and squeamish in good directions, for thoroughness leads more rapidly to the development of character and the acquisition of wisdom. It accelerates progress and unfoldment, and while it leads the bad to something better, it spurs the good to higher and ever higher heights of usefulness and power. End of chapter 5. Recording by Andrea Fiore. Chapter 6 of The Mastery of Destiny. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Andrea Fiore. The Mastery of Destiny by James Allen. Chapter 6. Mind Building and Life Building. Everything, both in nature and the works of man, is produced by a process of building. The rock is built up of atoms. The planet, the animal, and men are built up of cells. A house is built of bricks, and a book is built of letters. A world is composed of a large number of forms, and a city of a large number of houses. The arts, sciences, and institutions of a nation are built up by the efforts of individuals. The history of a nation is the building of its deeds. The process of building necessitates the alternate process of breaking down. Old forms that have served their purpose are broken up, and the material of which they are composed enters into new combinations. There is reciprocal integration and disintegration. In all compounded bodies, old cells are ceaselessly being broken up, and new cells are formed to take their place. The works of man also require to be continually renewed until they have become old and useless, when they are torn down, in order that some better purpose may be served. These two processes of breaking down and building up in nature are called death and life. In the artificial works of man, they are called destruction and restoration. This dual process, which obtains universally in things visible, also obtains universally in things invisible. As a body is built of cells and a house of bricks, so a man's mind is built of thoughts. The various characters of men are none other than compounds of thoughts of varying combinations. Herein we see the deep truth of the saying, "As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he." Individual characteristics are fixed processes of thought, that is, they are fixed in the sense that they have become such an integral part of the character that they can only be altered or removed by a protracted effort of the will and by much self-discipline. Character is built in the same way as a tree or a house is built, namely, by the ceaseless addition of new material, and that material is thought. By the aid of millions of bricks a city is built. By the aid of millions of thoughts a mind, a character, is built. Every man is a mind-builder, whether he recognizes it or not. Every man must perforce think, and every thought is another brick laid down in the edifice of mind. Such brick-laying is done loosely and carelessly by the vast number of people, the result being unstable and tottering characters that are ready to go down under the first little gust of trouble or temptation. Some also put into the building of their minds large numbers of impure thoughts. These are so many rotten bricks that crumble away as fast as they are put in, leaving always an unfinished and unsightly building, and one which can afford no comfort and no shelter for its possessor. Debilitating thoughts about one's health, enervating thoughts concerning unlawful pleasures, weakening thoughts of failure, and sickly thoughts of self-pity and self-praise are useless bricks with which no substantial mind-temple can be raised. Pure thoughts, wisely chosen and well-placed, are so many durable bricks which will never crumble away, and from which a finished and beautiful building, and one which affords comfort and shelter for its possessor, can be rapidly erected. Bracing thoughts of strength, of confidence, of duty, inspiring thoughts of a large, free, unfettered, and unselfish life, are useful bricks with which a substantial mind-temple can be raised, and the building of such a temple necessitates that old and useless habits of thought be broken down and destroyed. Build thee more stately mansions, O my soul, as the swift seasons roll. Each man is the builder of himself. If he is the occupant of a jerry-built hovel of a mind that lets in the rains of many troubles, and through which blow the keen winds of oft-reoccurring disappointments, let him get to work to build a more noble mansion, which will afford him better protection against those mental elements. Trying to weakly shift the responsibility for his jerry-building onto the devil, or his forefathers, or anything or anybody but himself, will neither add to his comfort nor help him to build a better habitation. When he wakes up to a sense of his responsibility and the approximate estimate of his power, then he will commence to build like a true workman, and will produce a symmetrical and finished character that will endure and be cherished by posterity, and which, while affording a never-failing protection for himself, will continue to give shelter to many a struggling one when he has passed away. The whole visible universe is framed on a few mathematical principles. All the wonderful works of man in the material world have been brought about by the rigid observance of a few underlying principles, and all that there is to the making of a successful, happy, and beautiful life is the knowledge and application of a few simple root principles. If a man is to erect a building that is to resist the fiercest storms, he must build it on a simple mathematical principle, or law, such as the square or the circle. If he ignores this, his edifice will topple down even before it is finished. Likewise, if a man is to build up a successful, strong, and exemplary life, a life that will stoutly resist the fiercest storms of adversity and temptation, it must be framed on a few simple, undeviating moral principles. Four of these principles are justice, rectitude, sincerity, and kindness. These four ethical truths are to the making of a life what the four lines of a square are to the building of a house. If a man ignores them and thinks to obtain success and happiness and peace by injustice, trickery, and selfishness, he is in the position of a builder who imagines he can build a strong and durable habitation while ignoring the relative arrangement of mathematical lines, and he will, in the end, obtain only disappointment and failure. He may, for a time, make money, which will delude him into believing that injustice and dishonesty pay well, but in reality his life is so weak and unstable that it is ready at any moment to fall, and when a critical period comes, as come it must, his affairs, his reputation, and his riches crumble to ruins, and he is buried in his own desolation. It is totally impossible for a man to achieve a truly successful and happy life who ignores the four moral principles enumerated, whilst the man who scrupulously observes them in all his dealings can no more fail of success and blessedness than the earth can fail of the light and the warmth of the sun, so long as it keeps to its lawful orbit, for he is working in harmony with the fundamental laws of the universe. He is building his life on a basis which cannot be altered or overthrown, and therefore all that he does will be so strong and durable, and all the parts of his life will be so coherent, harmonious, and firmly knit, that it cannot possibly be brought to ruin. In all the universe, forms which are built up by the great invisible and unerring power will be found that the observance of mathematical law is carried out with unfailing exactitude down to the most minute detail. The microscope reveals the fact that the infinitely small is as perfect as the infinitely great. A snowflake is as perfect as a star. Likewise, in the erection of a building by man, the strictest attention must be paid to every detail. A foundation must first be laid, and although it is to be buried and hidden, it must receive the greatest care, and be made stronger than any other part of the building. Then stone upon stone, brick upon brick, is carefully laid with the aid of the plumb line, until at last the building stands complete in its durability, strength, and beauty. Even so it is with the life of a man. He who would have a life secure and blessed, a life freed from the miseries and failures to which so many fall victims, must carry the practice of the moral principles into every detail of his life, into every momentary duty and trivial transaction. In every little thing he need be thorough and honest, neglecting nothing. To neglect or misapply any little detail, be he commercial man, agriculturist, professional man, or artisan, is the same as neglecting a stone or a brick in a building, and it will be a source of weakness and trouble. The majority of those who fail and come to grief do so through neglecting the apparently insignificant details. It is a common error to suppose that little things can be passed by, and that the greater things are more important, and should receive all attention. But a cursory glance at the universe, as well as a little serious reflection on life, will teach the lesson that nothing great can exist which is not made up of small details, and in the composition of which every detail is perfect. He who adopts the four ethical principles as the law and base of his life, who raises the edifice of character upon them, who in his thoughts and words and actions does not wander from them, whose every duty and every passing transaction is performed in strict accordance with their exactions, such a man, laying down the hidden foundation of integrity of heart securely and strongly, cannot fail to raise up a structure which shall bring him honor, and he is building a temple in which he can repose in peace and blessedness, even the strong and beautiful temple of his life. End of chapter 6. Recording by Andrea Fiore. Chapter 7 of The Mastery of Destiny. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Andrea Fiore. The Mastery of Destiny by James Allen. Chapter 7. Cultivation of Concentration. Concentration, or the bringing of the mind to a center and keeping it there, is vitally necessary to the accomplishment of any task. It is the father of thoroughness and the mother of excellence. As a faculty, it is not an end in itself, but is an aid to all faculties, all work. Not a purpose in itself, it is yet a power which serves all purposes. Like steam in mechanics, it is a dynamic force in the machinery of the mind and the functions of life. The faculty is a common possession, though in its perfection it is rare. Just as will and reason are common possessions, though a perfectly poised will and a comprehensive reason are rare possessions, the mystery which some modern mystical writers have thrown around it is entirely superlative. Every successful man, in whatever direction his success may lie, practices concentration, though he may know nothing about it as a subject of study. Every time one becomes absorbed in a book or task, or is rapt in devotion or assiduous in duty, concentration, in a greater or lesser degree, is brought into play. Many books purporting to give instructions on concentration make its practice and acquisition an end in itself. Then this, there is no surer nor swifter way to its destruction. The fixing of the eye upon the tip of the nose, upon a doorknob, a picture, a mystical symbol, or the portrait of a saint, or the centering of the mind upon the navel, the pineal gland, or some imaginary point in space. I have seen all these methods seriously advised in works on this subject, with the object of acquiring concentration. It is like trying to nourish the body by merely moving the jaws in the act of eating, without taking food. Such methods prevent the end at which they aim. They lead towards dispersion and not concentration, towards weakness and imbecility rather than towards power and intelligence. I have met those who have squandered, by these practices, what measure of concentration they at first possessed, and have become the prey of a weak and wandering mind. Concentration is an aid to the doing of something. It is not the doing of something in itself. A ladder has no divine knowledge, or the sweeping of a floor, without resorting to methods which have no practical bearing in life. For what is concentration but the bringing of a well-controlled mind to the doing of that which has to be done? He who does his work in an aimless or hurried or thoughtless manner, and resorts to his artificial concentration methods, to his doorknob, his picture, or nasal extremity, in order to gain that which he imagines to be some kind of mystical power, but which is a very ordinary and practical quality, though he may drift towards insanity, and I knew one man who became insane by these practices, he will not increase in steadiness of mind. The great enemy of concentration, and therefore of all skill and power, is a wavering, wandering, undisciplined value in and of itself, but only in so far as it enables us to reach something which we could not otherwise reach. In like manner, concentration is that which enables the mind to accomplish with ease that which it would be otherwise impossible to accomplish. But of itself it is a dead thing, and not a living accomplishment. Concentration is so interwoven with the uses of life that it cannot be separated from duty, and he who tries to acquire it apart from his task, his duty, will not only fail, but will diminish, and not increase, his mental control and executive capacity, and so render himself less and less fit to succeed in his undertakings. A scattered and undisciplined army would be useless. To make it effective in action and swift in victory, it must be solidly concentrated and masterfully directed. Scattered and diffused thoughts are weak and worthless. Thoughts marshaled, commanded, and directed upon at a given point are invincible. Confusion, doubt, and difficulty give way before their masterly approach. Concentrated thought enters largely into all successes and informs all victories. There is no more secret about its acquirement than about any other acquisition, for it is governed by the underlying principle of all development, namely, practice. To be able to do a thing, you must begin to do it, and keep on doing it until the thing is mastered. This principle prevails universally in all arts, sciences, trades, in all learning, conduct, religion. To be able to paint, one must paint. To know how to use a tool skillfully, he must use the tool. To become learned, he must learn. To become wise, he must do wise things. And to successfully concentrate his mind, he must concentrate it. But the doing is not all. It must be done with energy and intelligence. The beginning of concentration, then, is to go to your daily task and put your mind on it, bringing all your intelligence and mental energy to a focus upon that which has to be done. And every time the thoughts are found wandering aimlessly away, they should be brought promptly back to the thing in hand. Thus the center upon which you are to bring your mind to a point is not your pineal gland or a point in space, but the work which you are doing every day, and your object in thus concentrating is to be able to do your work with smooth rapidity and consummate skill. For until you can thus do your work, you have not gained any degree of control over the mind. You have not acquired the power of concentration. This powerful focusing of one's thought and energy and will upon the doing of things is difficult at first, as everything worth acquiring is difficult. But daily efforts, strenuously made and patiently followed up, will soon lead to such a measure of self-control as will enable one to bring a strong and penetrating mind to bear upon any work undertaken, a mind that will quickly comprehend all the details of the work, and dispose of them with accuracy and dispatch. He will thus, as his concentrative capacity increases, enlarge his usefulness in the scheme of things, and increase his value to the world, thus inviting nobler opportunities, and opening the door to higher duties. He will also experience the joy of a wider and fuller life. In the process of concentration, there are the four following stages. 1. Attention. 2. Contemplation. 3. Abstraction. 4. Activity in repose. At first the thoughts are arrested, and the mind is fixed upon the object of concentration, which is the task in hand. This is attention. The mind is then roused into vigorous thought concerning the way of proceeding with the task. This is contemplation. Protracted contemplation leads to a condition of mind in which the doors of the senses are all closed against the entrance of outside distractions, the thoughts being wrapped in, and solely and intensely centered upon the work in hand. This is abstraction. The mind thus centered in profound cogitation reaches a state in which the maximum of work is accomplished with the minimum of friction. This is activity in repose. Attention is the first stage in all successful work. Those who lack it fail in everything. Such are the lazy, the thoughtless, the indifferent, and incompetent. When attention is followed by an awakening of the mind to serious thought, then the second stage is reached. To ensure success in all ordinary, worldly undertakings, it is not necessary to go beyond these two stages. They are reached, in a greater or lesser degree, by all that large army of skilled and competent workers which carries out the work of the world in its manifold departments, and only a comparatively small number reach the third stage of abstraction, for when abstraction is reached, we have entered the sphere of genius. In the first two stages, the work and the mind are separate, and the work is done more or less laboriously, and with a degree of friction. But in the third stage, a marriage of the work with the mind takes place. There is a fusion, a union, and the two become one. Then there is a superior efficiency with less labor and friction. In the perfection of the first two stages, the mind is objectively engaged, and is easily drawn from its center by external sights and sounds. But when the mind has attained perfection in abstraction, the subjective method of working is accomplished, as distinguished from the objective. The thinker is then oblivious to the outside world, but is vividly alive in his mental operations. If spoken to, he will not hear, and if plied with more vigorous appeals, he will bring back his mind to outside things as one coming out of a dream. Indeed, this abstraction is a kind of waking dream, but its similarity to a dream ends with the subjective state. It does not obtain in the mental operations of that state, in which, instead of the confusion of dreaming, there is perfect order, penetrating insight, and a wide range of comprehension. Whoever attains to perfection in abstraction will manifest genius in the particular work upon which his mind is centered. Inventors, artists, poets, scientists, philosophers, and all men of genius are men of abstraction. They accomplish subjectively, and with ease, that which the objective workers, men who have not yet attained beyond the second stage in concentration, cannot accomplish with the most strenuous labor. When the fourth stage, that of activity and repose, is attained, then concentration in its perfection is acquired. I am unable to find a single word which will fully express this dual condition of intense activity combined with steadiness, or rest, and have therefore employed the term activity in repose. The term appears contradictory, but the simple illustration of a spinning top will serve to explain the paradox. When a top spins at the maximum velocity, the friction is reduced to the minimum, and the top assumes that condition of perfect repose, which is a sight so beautiful to the eye and so captivating to the mind of the schoolboy, who then says his top is asleep. The top is apparently motionless, but it is at rest, not of inertia, but of intense and perfectly balanced activity. So the mind that has acquired perfect concentration is, when engaged in that intense activity of thought which results in productive work of the highest kind, in a state of quiet poise and calm repose. Externally, there is no apparent activity, no disturbance, and the face of a man who has acquired this power will assume a more or less radiant calmness, and the face will be more sublimely calm when the mind is most intensely engaged in active thought. Each stage of concentration has its particular power. Thus the first stage, when perfected, leads to usefulness, the second leads to skill, ability, talent. The third leads to originality and genius, while the fourth leads to mastery and power, and makes leaders and teachers of men. In the development of concentration, also, as in all objects of growth, the following stages embody the preceding ones in their entirety. Thus contemplation, attention is contained. In abstraction, both attention and contemplation are embodied. And he who has reached the last stage brings into play, in the act of contemplation, all the four stages. He who has perfected himself in concentration is able, at any moment, to bring his thoughts to a point upon any matter, and to search into it with the strong light of an active comprehension. He can both take a thing up and lay it down with equal deliberation. He has learned how to use his thinking faculties to fixed purposes, and guide them towards definite ends. He is an intelligent doer of things, and not a weak wanderer amid chaotic thought. Decision, energy, alertness, as well as deliberation, judgment, and gravity, accompany the habit of concentration, and that vigorous mental training which its cultivation involves, leads through an ever-increasing usefulness and success in worldly occupations, towards that higher form of concentration called meditation, in which the mind becomes divinely illumined and acquires the heavenly knowledge. End of chapter 7. Recording by Andrea Fiore. Chapter 8 of The Mastery of Destiny. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Andrea Fiore. The Mastery of Destiny by James Allen. Chapter 8. Practice of Meditation. When aspiration is united to concentration, the result is meditation. When a man intensely desires to reach and realize a higher, purer, and more radiant life than the merely worldly and pleasure-loving life, he engages in aspiration, and when he earnestly concentrates his thoughts upon the finding of that life, he practices meditation. Without intense aspiration, there can be no meditation. Lethargy and indifference are fatal to its practice. The more intense the nature of a man, the more readily will he find meditation, and the more successfully will he practice it. A fiery nature will most rapidly scale the heights of truth in meditation, when its aspirations have become sufficiently awakened. Concentration is necessary to worldly success. Meditation is necessary to spiritual success. Worldly skill and knowledge are acquired by concentration. Spiritual skill and knowledge are acquired by meditation. By concentration, a man can scale the highest heights of genius, but he cannot scale the heavenly heights of truth. To accomplish this, he must meditate. By concentration, a man may acquire the wonderful comprehension and vast power of a Caesar. By meditation, he may reach the divine wisdom and perfect peace of a Buddha. The perfection of concentration is power. The perfection of meditation is wisdom. By concentration, men acquire skill in the doing of things of life, in science, art, trade, etc. But by meditation, they acquire skill in life itself, in right living, enlightenment, wisdom, etc. Saints, sages, saviors, wise men and divine teachers, are the finished products of holy meditation. The four stages in concentration are brought into play in meditation.